This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Now, normally on this show, we deal with serious topics with real-world implications, and we do our best to make sure everything's factual and bring you content that informs your life in useful and meaningful ways. But today, well, with Halloween just a little over a week away, we thought we'd get a little spooky. That's not to say that today's show won't be meaningful, but depending on your beliefs, today's show is kind of for entertainment purposes only. Or is it? That's for you to decide. Today we're talking Indiana ghost lore, and we're going to spend the whole hour with the man who's written several books on Indiana ghost stories, the Haunted Indiana series, the Haunted Travels of Indiana, and a few others. Mark Merriman, hello.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, normally we call out for comments on social media, but today's show is pre-recorded. However, that does not mean we don't want to hear your own ghost stories. So please share them with us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana, and we'll do our best to respond, retweet, etc. Okay, first off, Mark, I'm so glad you're here. We'll get to the actual ghost stories in just a few minutes. But first, I want to talk about you and the journey of collecting all these stories. These books have been around for a while. The first Haunted Indiana book was published in 97, so it's been over 20 years.
Yep.
But I still want to ask, what made you want to write about Indiana ghost stories?
I actually, like so many of the best things in my life, it was almost serendipitous that I ended up writing the books. The story is pretty simple. You know, like a lot of people, I fell in love with ghost stories sitting around a campfire as a kid. And that unlike a lot of people, that love never quite left me. I always had that fascination. Never, ever in a million years intended on writing a book. But I did my graduate work at Duke University, and when I was in North Carolina, I found out that North Carolina had some books on North Carolina ghost stories. I thought, how cool. I can't wait to get back to Indiana and read the book on Indiana ghost stories. That would be really neat. So when I finally came back, I checked around and found out that there was no book on Indiana ghost stories. IU, the folklore department, had tried to write a book like that, but they never published it. So I happened to be talking in a phone conversation with the dean of the folklore department from IU, and I said, why didn't you ever write this book? And she said something to me that I later wrote down and had above my computer where I worked for a lot of years. She said, try as hard as you want. You'll never find enough ghost stories in Indiana to make a book. And I hung up the phone, and I looked at the phone, and I said, let the games begin.
And then you wrote three or four, however many it's been.
Seven, yes.
How did you go about collecting these stories? What's the process there?
You know, it really changed and evolved throughout the years. When I first began, really, it had not really been done before, so I spent a ton of time in places like historical societies and newspaper morgues. But the really cool thing about it is, as the books came out in succession, there's a great expression they use in the Deep South, talk spook. More and more people came to want to talk spook with me. So really, it became, in that sense, easier, because it became something where the public began to tell me their stories. And then it was a matter of sort of sifting through and figuring out which stories were which. And really, the research is the most fun part of it for me.
And that involves just hearing people's stories, hearing people's sort of quick histories, and then that leads you to another person who might know something. Do you sort of go by a process to, verify it as much as a ghost story can be verified?
Right. What you're doing is you're verifying that, in fact, it is a legend. There's a lot of things that go through that. I tell people to do this job, you have to be one part yellow journalist and two parts detective, because you do end up talking to a lot of people sort of trying to mine the legend out there. But then you also spend an awful lot of time just trying to verify if there's any history behind it. My wife will attest I'm 12 years old inside, and so the really cool part was being able to go all over the state to these some incredibly spooky places and hearing these ghost stories, and then sort of just being able to process that and regurgitate them, if you will, in written form. So it was a lot of fun.
So spooky places, were you ever afraid going to these places?
I will say that there were a couple places that were seriously creepy. Did a lot of very normal places, like ghost stories in hospitals and schools and things like that. There were literally a couple places that just really were Seriously creepy. One of them, I spent the night in the historic fort in Fort Wayne, locked on a March night with no heat or electricity, just me and a docent sitting there by a campfire listening to ghost stories in this historic fort. And that kind of got to me, but without a doubt, the weirdest place that I ever visited is since gone, but it was Central State Hospital in the middle of Indianapolis, which was an abandoned 19th century only phrase for this is insane asylum. It wasn't a mental health institution. It was insane asylum. It was abandoned when I toured it. But let me tell you, it looked like a movie set. The gentleman that gave me the tour offered to do it again that night by candlelight. And I said, thank you very much. But by the time sun sets tonight, I'm going to be back up north with my wife and daughter. Okay. I'm not chasing Casper through this place by candlelight. No, that's just not going to happen.
Probably not Casper. It'd probably be someone a little bit more malicious. Now, you put out 3 books in as many years back in the late 90s. Did you plan to write that many that fast?
No, really, that was driven a lot by the demand at the time. And the fact, as I was saying, that, you know, the more you go, it kind of develops an energy of its own, and people are coming to you with the stories. I never intended on writing 1, let alone 3 in that a short amount of time, but it was an awful lot of fun to be able to do.
All right, so let's dig into it. We've got about 5 minutes. What's a good one to start with?
Oh, man, there are absolutely so many to be able to do. One of the things, by my very nature, I love the history. I am not a ghost hunter. I'm not a ghost believer. I'm a storyteller.
You're not, really?
No. When your bed is levitating and the walls are bleeding, please, I'm not the one to call. You know, not unless you want to see me scream like a schoolgirl and wet myself. No, that's not going to happen. But going around the state and doing some of the history of the area, you begin to dig up some odd corners of Indiana history that have ghost lore attached to them that are an awful lot of fun for that. One of them being that, most folks don't know that the worst train wreck in terms of loss of human life in the first half of the 20th century was in Hammond. And it was the Hagenbeck-Wallace circus train.
The circus train.
Yes.
When was it? 1918?
June 22nd, 1918.
Okay.
And it was a horrendous, horrendous event. And that is, the circus had performed the day before in Michigan City, and they had 2 trains that were going to go to Hammond. And as the first one came through with a few of the performers, a lot of the setup people, they call them roustabouts, as they were almost in Hammond, almost there at a little place called Ivanhoe, they saw a hot box, which is a gearbox that is meant to glow if it runs out of grease. And so they pulled off on the siding partially and to fix that, and the lights went red behind them. But coming in behind them was a empty troop train on its way to Chicago to pick up the troops for World War I. And the engineer later reported that of the troop train that he had been working for 18 hours and was dead asleep at the switch. And the estimates varied wildly because the reports were that he plowed into the back of the train anywhere between 30 and 60 miles an hour and piled it up like so much kindling, which is exactly what it was. It was a Civil War era train made of wood and heated and lit by gasoline-powered lamps. So you had at least 86 people killed in something like 3 minutes. Terrible, terrible tragedy. Got to hear that story because of sort of a non-ghost story, and this is sort of an aside, but what happened was a lot of the people there, they had no identification for. A lot of these people were people who really didn't have a home, per se. So what they did is they buried a number of these just over the border in a suburb of Chicago in a mass grave in a cemetery. And the plot was owned by the circus sort of union. And what they did is they put statues of elephants on top of the grave with their trunks lowered in grief. And over the years, the legend developed that there had been animals killed in the wreck too, and the animals were buried there. And the legend went further to say that if you went there late at night, you would hear the animals screech and howl and things like that. In reality, no animals had been on that train. However, that's what the legend was. Well, about 1977, a local policeman was driving by late at night, and he saw the cemetery, remembered that that legend, so he went in just for the fun of it on a lark, and he went to that grave, and sure enough, he actually did hear the animals, and he could hear the exotic animals, you know, howling and screeching and things like, couldn't believe his ears. And all these legends were absolutely true. Well, being a trained police officer, he decided that maybe it bore some investigation, so he did something that, believe it or not, no one had ever done before. He went home and looked at a map and realized that cemetery is about 2 miles from Brookfield Zoo. And that on warm summer evenings when the breeze was right, you could hear the animals from Brookfield Zoo. But when I heard that, I thought, wherever there's tragedy with that, there has to be some ghost stories. So it took me about 2 years to break into the railroading community. But when I did, I absolutely started hearing stories that had been handed down from the railroad community of fires seen in that area late at night. One particular lady told me that her father told her that as a young man working maintenance, they'd gotten a report that somebody had seen a fire by the track, so he went out there late at night with his supervisor, and they got there, and there was no fire, and he said it looked absolutely peaceful. But the supervisor said, you know, you better get down and just look around so that we can say we did it. And he said, as soon as I hit the ground, the scene didn't change. Everything I could see. But he said, all of a sudden, the sound was, and this is his words, like somebody opened the door to hell, because he said, I could hear screaming and what sounded like a fire and explosions and people moaning. And all around, what he was seeing was darkness and, you know, this peaceful sort of area. But what he was hearing was the sound of what had happened. And he said he turned around and jumped back in the locomotive. As soon as his foot left the ground, he could no longer hear that. And they got back there as soon as possible. He didn't even know the story of the wreck. And they asked what possible explanation there was, and that's when he learned about the wreck and the deaths and everything else. And he said at the end of his shift, he happened to pass by a calendar and realize that it was early in the morning on that day, on June the 22nd, the anniversary of the wreck.
Wow. Today we're talking Indiana ghost stories. We're spending the whole hour with Mark Merriman. He's the author of the Haunted Indiana book series. He's also written a few other collections of Indiana ghost lore. And up next, we'll dig into some of those stories, some more of them, including Terre Haute's Legend of Stiffy Green. And remember, today's show is pre-recorded, but we'd still love to hear your favorite Indiana ghost stories. Find us on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelzer. Stay with us and stay under the covers. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelzer. Before we get back to Indiana ghost lore, I want to tell you about the show we did yesterday on the state of recycling in Indiana. In short, it's not great, but getting better. Lots of good info in yesterday's show, and you can find it as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Back now with Mark Merriman. He's the author of the Haunted Indiana book series and a few other collections of Indiana ghost lore. Mark, can you tell us about Terre Haute philanthropist John Heinel and his now famous dog?
Yeah, that's really truly one of the Indiana classics, and well, that's one that I love to tell in when I speak to groups. Maybe just because it's a dog story, and I'm a huge dog guy, kind of guy, but. As with any story, there's always going to be some element of historical truth in there. And the truth of the matter is that in the early days of the 1900s in Terre Haute, there was a gentleman named John Heinel, who was one of the more well-known characters in the city. He was an old man, lived basically on his own. His wife had died a few years before. He never had any children. He ran the only florist shop in town, so if you wanted flowers, you had to know John. And he was alone in the world except for all of his friends and his dog, Stiffy Green, which is an odd name for a dog. But according to the legends that they tell, there were two reasons for the dog's name. The Stiffy part came because he was a bulldog. If you can picture the way a bulldog walks, kind of walk a little bit stiff-legged. And the green part came, and again, this is the part of the legend, because unlike any dog I've ever seen, supposedly this dog had dark green eyes. But whatever the reason, Stiffy Green and John Heinel were inseparable. And everybody knew that on warm summer evenings, John Heidel's favorite thing to do was to fill his pipe and get a walking stick, get the leash, call for Stiffy Green, and they'd walk the streets of Terre Haute, meeting all of his friends. But even on occasions like that, nobody got too close because everybody knew that Stiffy Green was very, very protective of his master. Never let anybody get too close. As a matter of fact, it was said that when John Heidel slept, Stiffy Green slept on the floor next to his side of the bed, guarding him in his sleep. And presumably, that's where he was when John Heidel passed away. Died of old age, a very peaceful death. Well, actually, I have really read the newspaper accounts of his funeral. It sounds like about half the town showed up to the funeral, but according to the story, the chief mourner was Stiffy Green. They took the dog to the Heidel mausoleum, or to the cemetery. To the funeral, and then to the Heidel family mausoleum in Highland Lawn Cemetery in Terre Haute, where they put John Heidel's casket in its place. And when they had done that, they shut that iron gate of the mausoleum with a bang, and that ought to be the end of the story, you'd think, but it isn't. Because it was only then that people kind of realized somebody needed to take Stiffy Green. So they talked about it, and one of John Heidel's distant cousins said he'd take the dog, but at first he didn't want to go. He growled, apparently, and snapped like he wanted to stay by his master. And eventually they got a rope, tied it around his collar, and drug him home, but by the next morning he had escaped. He had chewed through the rope. And so they looked all over town for him, and finally they found him standing guard outside the Heidel family mausoleum in Terre Haute. Highland Lawn Cemetery, I should say. So they drug him home again, tied him more securely, but this happened several times. He would always find a way to escape, always find his way back to the Heidel Mausoleum. So eventually, according to what the old legends say, the cemetery workers kind of adopted the dog. Sounds odd, but they put up a little shelter for him behind the mausoleum, and they would bring him in food. And apparently, from what they say, Stiffy Green had a pretty good life of it for a couple years, until he too died as an old dog. Well, here's where the story gets even weirder, because according to the legends, they say, once news of the dog's death leaked into the community, a group of John Heidel's friends got together, and they started a fund. And once they had enough money, they took the dog to a taxidermist who stuffed the dog into this startling likeness of life, which is really weird to our modern sensibilities, but actually I've come to learn was quite common back in that day. At any rate, once the dog's body was returned to a likeness of life, they took it back to the Heidel family mausoleum, and they opened up that gate, and they put the dog's body right next to John Heidel's casket. And one of the friends there is said to have remarked that it was appropriate now that the master and friend were together again. And with that, they shut that iron gate, and that still ought to be another good way to end the story, but it still is more to that story. Because according to what they say, the addendum is that just a few months later, early October, about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a cemetery worker who was putting his tools into his car. He'd had a long, hard day, wanted just to go home and have dinner with his wife. But as he was shutting the trunk, he heard something that made him stop because he heard barking coming from inside the cemetery. Well, that happens, of course. Stray dogs find their way in and out of the cemetery. But he knew, as a responsible worker, he had to find whatever dog had gotten in and run him out before he could go home. But as he followed the sound of the barking, a couple things began to bother him. The first is that it sounded familiar, almost like he'd heard it before. And the second is that as he was walking in the direction of the mausoleum, or of the barking, he realized he was walking in the direction of the Heidel family mausoleum. Just as he got to the hedge opposite that mausoleum, the barking stopped and it grew very, very silent. And from what he said, the worker crouched down behind that bush for a long, silent moment. And then he pulled back the bush and he looked across the mausoleum and he saw absolutely nothing. There was no dog there. Just some dumb dog had probably run its way in and then run its way out again. He stood up and decided to go home and tell his wife what a fool he'd been. But it was as he was turning back to his car that he saw something he later said he would never forget. Because along the fence that separates Highland Lawn from the streets of Terre Haute, through the dusk of that early autumn evening, he saw a figure, or actually a pair of figures. One was the shadowy figure of an old man with a pipe in his mouth and a walking stick in his hand, and padding contently by his side the figure of a little dog. Even from a distance, that worker swore the dog's eyes glowed green with peace and contentment, now that master and friend were together forever.
Stiffy Green. Oh, and later, the dog was left in the mausoleum, the stuffed dog was left in the mausoleum, and it suffered some vandalism in the 80s, right?
That's my understanding. And although I've not verified this, I understand that the dog is now, or a replica of the dog, is now in the Terre Haute Historical Museum.
Yeah, and you
can't verify that, but that's what I've been told.
No, I think that that's true, and you can go and visit him. You can go and see him, and those eyes are still green.
There you go.
And not too far from John Heinel's mausoleum is that of Terre Haute businessman Martin Sheets, who had some unique requests upon his death. Tell us about Martin Sheets.
That is a fun story. It really, really is. And it's one of those stories, and these do happen, where the actual history of it is about as bizarre as any ghost story that you could come up with. But Martin Sheets grew up in the late 1800s in Terre Haute. And when he was about 18 or so, he left Terre Haute to go down to Texas to strike it rich. And a lot of young men did that at the time. The only difference was he actually succeeded. And when he got back into town, came back to Terre Haute in about 1910 or so, he was a very rich young man, or a middle-aged man by that point. Very, very rich. He was also, though, how does one put this nicely? Eccentric. Eccentric may be even a kind way to describe it. I've actually read newspaper accounts at the time that talked about him getting into trouble with the police, because Martin Sheets would walk down the sidewalk of this rural farming community in a 10-gallon hat with a six-shooter on each hip. And a couple times, if there was any dispute he had with a merchant or whatever, that merchant would find a Colt 45 leveled at his chest, which, you know, was not a real popular thing to do at that point. But anyway, as he was a very wealthy man, he was actually very philanthropic with the community. He endowed a whole lot of the business or the charities around. He gave part of the library and part of the hospital there. But as Martin Sheets got older, he developed a really strange fear. Martin Sheets began to fear, for some reason, his phobia was that he would be buried alive. The idea being that he would fall into a coma, some fool doctor would call him dead, and he'd wake up in his casket 6 feet under the ground, which is nobody's idea of a good time. So Martin Sheets had the money to make sure that didn't happen. He built a huge mausoleum about 100 yards from John Heinel's mausoleum, but his is much larger. And when he died in 1936, he actually left a 50-page will with very specific instructions about his burial. He was to be buried above ground, unembalmed, in the mausoleum, and next to his casket were to be the following items: a rocking chair, a table, on that table a bottle of whiskey in a glass, and a live telephone line. Martin Sheets' idea was that if he woke up in his casket, he was going to pry off the lid, crawl out, go pour himself a drink, call for a ride home, and sit there and drink until the ride arrived. And from about 1936 to 1985, this was the only private mausoleum that we know of in the world that actually did have a live telephone line in it. I've actually spoken with the phone company that verified that. I talked to one of the workers there who was retired, said for 10 years part of his duties were every month he had to go to he had the key to the mausoleum, go in, pick up the phone, make sure there was a dial tone, and then he could hang it up and, you know, come back the next month. So really, really bizarre. But in 1985, the cemetery realized that if Martin hadn't gotten up in about 50 years, he probably wasn't gonna. So with the family's permission, he went to court, broke the will, and they removed the line. But for those 50 or so years, that was the only mausoleum that anybody had heard of with a live telephone line. Now, the ghost story attached to that actually doesn't have anything to do with Martin Sheets' death at all. It has to do with the death of his wife about 10 years later. Because Mrs. Sheets never remarried. She was an older lady, refused to live with any of her children. She was in very frail health. Everybody knew she had a bad heart. So everyone was shocked, but no one was particularly surprised when they found her dead of a heart attack on the kitchen floor. It was a very sad thing, of course. But when they found her, she was clutching the telephone. The supposition was that she felt the heart attack coming on, went to the phone to call for help, but the heart attack took her before she could make the call. And that made perfect sense. It made sense when they found her. It made sense at the funeral. It made sense right up until the moment that they took her casket to the Sheets Mausoleum to find the phone next to Martin Sheets' casket off the hook, leading some people to wonder if Mrs. Sheets got a phone call that she never expected to get.
Oh, man. Oh my goodness! This is almost too much. We're talking with Mark Merriman. He's the author of the Haunted Indiana books. Mark, I was also fascinated to read that the world's largest mass ghost hunt took place back in the '60s in Northwest Indiana. What in the world was that about?
You know, I can tell you the facts of the story, but what it's about is really inexplicable. Not so much the ghost story a part of that, but just what happened was inexplicable. And by the way, I am not the one that coined the phrase or named it the world's largest ghost hunt. That was actually the BBC that did a television special about it. Between Valparaiso and Chesterton was Campbell Road, which back in the 60s was a pretty rural road. And honestly, the ghost story itself is a fairly common one. It is referred to in ghost lore as a white woman story, meaning what meant by that is the white vaporous form of a woman appears by the side of the road pleading for help. And there's sort of a backstory there that she was a pioneer woman who she and her baby had been lost in a snowstorm and froze to death. And now she appears by the side of the road pleading for help. But what's odd is that that story had probably been around for many, many years. We don't know exactly how long, but at least since the early 1900s. And what the neighbors along that stretch of road said is that customarily over the Halloween season, they might get three or four cars of night of kids going down to see if they could see the ghost. But something inexplicable happened at about 1963. When three students came to Chesterton High School, returned to school on a Monday, and they simply made the comment that they had been out there the Saturday night before and they'd seen this woman. Well, that's all it took. The story swept through the school, and then it swept through Valparaiso High School, and then it swept through the Gary schools and Merrillville. And all of a sudden, why then? No one quite understands, but what had typically been just a trickle of people coming through became a tsunami. And by the third week in October, when the state police had a cordon off the area, the paper estimates were that they were getting between 6,000 and 10,000 people a night out there looking for the ghost. Now, I happened to talk to one of the retired state policemen who'd been out there that night, and he was telling me about how crazy it was. It was like a circus. And I said, so I got to ask you, was it spooky? Was it scary? He said, well, it wasn't so much spooky as it was scary. He said, we had about 6,000 or 10,000 people out there, more than a few of them fortified with liquid courage. A bunch of them had shotguns going to shoot them a ghost. I was convinced we were going to create some ghosts that night.
And so so how did the international news get a hold of this story? How did it end up on the BBC?
I don't know how they got a hold of it, but in 1973, the BBC was actually going around the world doing sort of worldwide ghost stories from across the world, and they showed up in Chesterton, and they taped a part of their special there, and they're the ones who first called it the world's largest mass recorded ghost hunt, which it probably very well could be. And so that's the kind of story where the really inexplicable part is not the ghost. It's what the real live people do. That's the scary stuff. And that's the ones that are still breathing air. What they do is probably far more irrational and far scarier than any spook ever could.
Absolutely. And so this was between Chesterton and Valparaiso. So I don't want to spark more mass hysteria, but was this somewhere just along State Road 49 or?
It's off of that. Yes, it's Campbell Road, and it's actually a major road in Valparaiso now. Valpo's kind of grown up to encompass that, but at the time it was much more wooded and things like that.
Any other reports of her, the White Lady, in more recent memory?
It's really interesting. About probably 10 years ago, I was doing a storytelling session and a book signing at a bookstore, and I told that story. And afterwards, as I was signing books, this very nice lady and her family came up, and she said, "So the White Lady that was seen by the side of the road." And I said, "You know what, that's just kind of an old legend. You can't really take that too seriously. That's kind of all over." She said, "So you've never known anybody who said they saw her?" And I said, no, I don't think those people exist." She said, "Well, let me introduce you to my husband and my son, because we live on Campbell Road, and they've both seen her on individual times." So I don't know. And that's really the fun part about it. That's where I end up with so many of the ghost stories, is I don't know, and I'm not even sure I want to know. Sometimes the greatest fun for me is in the wondering, and I think that's the power of ghost stories, is just that sense of wonder of, I don't think, but who among us really knows?
More Indiana ghost stories coming up next with Mark Merriman, author of the Haunted Indiana book series. Stay with us for the story of who's believed by some to be America's most prolific female serial killer. And today's show is pre-recorded, but we'd love your ghost stories if you want to share them. We'll do our best to retweet. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Don't go to sleep. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back talking Indiana ghost lore with the author of the Haunted Indiana book series, Mark Merriman. So until I found your books, I hadn't heard of many of these stories. And there's one that sort of originated in Mexico that kind of has Indiana ties too. Tell me about La Llorona.
Yeah, so many times ghosts become, and ghost stories become, sort of portable. And a real example of that is in an area called Cudahy, which is really between Gary and Hammond. There is a story of a young mother who was, in the early day of automobiles, was apparently driving with her children, and the car, inclement weather, slid off the road and went into the river, and her children were swept away. And ever since then, it's said that she stands by the side of the road searching for her children and crying out for her children. Well, what's interesting is, as probably a lot of people would recognize, there's even a movie about it out right now, that is actually a transplantation of a legend that came from Mexico City. See, Cudahy was settled in large part by Mexican immigrants, and there's a story that goes all the way back to the 13th century of a woman who, in the original legend in Mexico, drowned her children in the river and then appeared by the side of the river calling their names and crying for them. And so it really became a part of that culture's history. And when they moved north to Indiana, they I guess La Llorona hitchhiked for a ride along the way.
And there's another story that kind of connects to that about a spectral bride.
Yeah, that's interesting. That is also on Klein Avenue, only it is north into Hammond, where it was in predominantly a area that was Polish in origin. And the story there is of a spectral bride, which is a whole part of ghost lore. But this is a story of a young Catholic girl that, according to the story, fell in love with somebody outside of her neighborhood, outside of her Catholic faith, and outside of her ethnicity. and the two of them were supposed to run away together, and they had agreed to meet down by the Calumet River where they could sneak off and get married, because they had been sneaking off there already and sort of meeting in secret along the Calumet. And so she put on the day that she was to run away, she put on her wedding dress and hailed a cab and went down by the river, and the young man never showed up. And so, obviously despondent, she threw herself into the river and drowned. And so ever since then, it was said that, particularly in cabs driving down Klein Avenue, they would see the vaporous form of a bride by the side of the road. And if you see her, supposedly check your rearview mirror, because within a mile or so, you can look back in your rearview mirror and see her there in your rearview mirror, because she's in the back seat. And so that actually is a story that was told, and there's a variant, a distant variant of that, that was told in Poland. And a lot of these legends serve to reinforce lessons that the community wanted to teach. And in this case, it was sort of stay within your faith system, stay within your ethnic group, don't vary too far outside, or something bad will happen. So yeah, both of those are really very cultural ghost stories.
Yeah, these stories sort of seem to serve a purpose, but there's one that's really, really creepy, and this one is true. The ghost element, I'm not sure, but the story of Belle Gunness, that is creepy and fascinating. I'd never heard of her until I found your books. Tell us about her.
Oh, yeah, and that is a whole subsection of American crime lore. And it is one of the true ends in really one of the true historical mysteries that we have. Belle Gunness in early days of the 19th or the 20th century. Belle Gunness was a widow, a convenient widow, because before moving to La Porte, she had had two husbands who died under mysterious circumstances. One of them died on the one day where he had two life insurance policies that overlapped.
Really?
Yes, absolutely true story. So she did real well, but she was just getting started. She was a woman of industry, because she took the earnings from the insurance on her two dead husbands and bought a farm outside La Porte. She was Norwegian, so she began to advertise in Norwegian newspapers across the United States. You can still see those if you look them up. Advertisements that said, here I am, this poor, hapless widow in this beautiful farm in La Porte. Gee, if I could just find a good, sturdy Norwegian man to come help me run this farm, buy into this farm, and, you know, we could become partners in this. Well, that kind of an appeal really brought him coming. So between 8 that we know for sure, but the conservative estimate is more than 40 of these men would come to the farm, and they would bring their checkbook, and they would buy into the farm, and she would cash the check, and then they'd never be seen again. She actually, that we later found out, buried them in pits on the farm or fed them to her hogs. And like I say, between eight, that's a very, very conservative number. More likely upwards of 40 men met their deaths. The other thing she would do is, at the time, if you had a child you couldn't afford to raise, she would, for a fee, take on that child with the agreement that she would raise it to adulthood, and she would take your money to do that. That was actually not an unheard of arrangement back in those days, and sadly, a number of those children, in fact, almost all of them, were never seen again. A real, real cold-blooded gal, Belle.
Wow.
And where the mystery comes in is on April 28th, 1908, there was a fire at her farm. About that time, people were starting to nose into her business, noticed that a lot of people disappeared around there. Well, right about then, there was a fire. Burned down the house, but the basement was left intact. And in the basement, it was found three of her children's bodies laid out one next to each other, and then a woman's body wearing Belle's clothes and jewelry, but missing its head. And the head was never found. The problem is that that woman's body was significantly smaller than Belle. So the question arose, had Belle and her children been murdered, laid down in the basement, and then the house set, or had Belle lured another woman to the house, murdered her in order to escape? And there are gunnessologists, they call themselves, who still will bicker and argue about this. Books have been written. There have been television specials. Recently read a, listened to a two-hour podcast on this. And the truth of the matter is no one knows. But 3 years ago, 4 years ago, University of Indianapolis Forensics Department actually went to court, got an order, and they exhumed the body, this headless body, out of Bell's grave with an attempt to draw out mitochondrial DNA to establish once and for all if she was the one who had died. But those findings have never been published, and I'm not sure if that means they weren't able to construct that DNA sequence or what it is. But whether or not Bell Gunness did escape with or literally get away with murder, or whether she in turn became the victim of murder, is still hotly, hotly contested. But wherever there's tragedy in history, you're going to get a ghost story. And needless to say, they've reconstructed a house on the basement. The basement is much the same as when they found the bodies, but there's a newer house on it. And there have been stories for generations around LaPorte that if you drive past there late at night or try to pull in, that you'll see a large woman, Bell was something along the lines of 6 feet tall, in a black dress come rushing at you out of the fields, waving her arms. The family, I actually toured the house the day before Halloween a number of years ago, and they told about things moving in the house and about they had hired painters to come in, she said. It was a mom with some young kids, and she had hired painters, and one of the painters reported that he had gone into a room and set up the ladder, put the can of paint on top of the ladder, turned around, walked about 3 feet away, and only to have the can of paint come off of the ladder, go 3 feet through the air, and pour itself over his head. Oh. So maybe Bell was objecting. I don't know.
Wow. Minus the ghost story, that is a creepy, creepy story of,
absolutely
of Indiana history. Okay, so most of us know that Amelia Earhart died in the Central Pacific. But some people believe that her ghost made it back to Indiana.
That's correct. Those are some old stories, too. And when she took off for that round-the-world trip, she was actually an adjunct professor at Purdue. And she had been brought in to be more or less to teach some classes, but more or less to be an example to the women there at Purdue that they didn't have to simply fall into the traditional roles there and the traditional vocational choices. And the plane in which she disappeared was a gift to her from the Purdue University Aviation Department, and she had done all of her workup flights from the Purdue airport. So really, Purdue played a large part in that that whole venture that ended so tragically. And again, once again, you know, I always say that ghost stories are what happens when history meets imagination. And since her disappearance there, there have been reports late at night at what was at first a hangar, and now, well, a few years ago was part of the lobby there, that the figure, showy figure of a woman in pilot's gear has been seen traipsing about at night. One of the stories that's told is that during World War II, and this is true, the Purdue Airport became a part of the Army Air Corps, and they were testing out aviation fuel there, which meant that they had an armed guard around the building at all times. And according to the story that they tell, one night they were working on this fuel and trying to see if it was going to do what they thought it would do when they heard the sound of gunfire coming from outside. And they ran out to find a guard badly, badly shaken, firing into the air. And when they asked him what had happened, he said that he had been approached by a figure out of the darkness in the shadows, and he had called for it to halt, but it kept on walking. So he leveled his gun and said, "Halt or I'll shoot," and it kept on walking towards him. So he fired, and it kept right on coming, and the closer he got, he saw that it was a woman in a pilot's jacket, and he fired two or three more times, but it went right through her, and then she disappeared.
Oh, my gosh. Again, too much. We're here with author Mark Merriman. He wrote the Haunted Indiana book series. There was also the time that Indiana almost went to war with Kentucky over a case of body snatching. When was this?
Yes. Wait, doesn't everybody know that? Didn't your third grade Indiana history teacher teach you that?
No, come on now. No, I didn't learn that third grade.
That is one that we have left off, and it is another somewhat macabre, grisly part of our history, but body snatching was actually a big problem in Indiana in the late 1800s. It was all over the United States, but in Indiana it was particularly acute. In 1890, Indianapolis had 315 cases of body snatching in 3 months. And that elicited something they called the Resurrectionist Riots, where a medical school was burned to the ground because these body snatchers were actually working for the medical schools, and they were stealing fresh bodies for research, for anatomy, for dissection. And it was quite common that happened, but Indiana had a couple very well-known body snatchers. But the case you're referring to happened right about 1890, when one day an anatomy professor from the Louisville School of Medicine crossed the river in Indiana, went to a small town, went to a bar in the small town, found a guy there who was probably deep into his cups, and he began to quiz him about any local deaths, anybody died recently, where was the cemetery, this kind of pumping him for information. And when he was done, he gave the man $5 and said, let's just forget this conversation happened. And then he got back into his horse and buggy and drove back across the bridge into Louisville. Well, the man took the money, but he didn't keep his mouth shut. He went to the local sheriff, and he told him, apparently, and this part is all actually historically verified, told the local sheriff about the conversation, and the sheriff recognized that here was a probable case of upcoming body snatching. So what he did is he laid out a trap. He got a posse to lay an ambush around the cemetery for a couple nights, and sure enough, the second night, up came the horse and buggy. They alighted, this doctor with two or three of his helpers and shovels, and they went over to the grave. But before they could start digging, one of the members of the posse got trigger happy, and he shot and actually killed one of the helpers, and the doctor was wounded. Well, the posse came in and arrested the doctor for body snatching. But by the next morning, they realized they had a problem. And this is one of those arcane things in legal circles. But because they had not actually started digging, you cannot charge someone with body snatching if they hadn't started digging, because it's not illegal to be in a cemetery even at night with a shovel. And that's all he had done. So when this came to light, Kentucky, in fact, the governor of Kentucky, demanded his release. Demanded this anatomy professor's release. And the local authorities in Indiana said, no, we think we're going to keep hold of this guy for a while till we can figure out what we're going to charge him with. In which case, Kentucky said, well, if you don't want to let him go, we're going to send our militia across the river, and we're just going to bust him out of jail. Well, about this time, the governor of Indiana said, well, you know what, you're welcome to try that, but my militia is going to be waiting. And so for 3 days, you literally, and this is true, had two militias across the river from each other with artillery pieces trained on each other, okay, all over this case of body snatching and what was going to happen to this doctor. The odd thing about that is what happened next was we have no idea. I literally tried doing about 3 months worth of research, reading those old newspapers, and the story simply disappeared from all of the press as quickly as it was in there. It was in very well covered at the time, and then it was just dropped. And there was never any evidence of this doctor ever having been brought to trial or anything. His name does not appear in any court records. My guess is that cooler heads prevailed and the doctor was kind of quietly repatriated to Kentucky, but that didn't receive any press at all. But once again, of course, you know, ghost lore is what happens when history meets imagination. And what they claim is if you're by this old cemetery late at night, people have reported seeing a horse and buggy pulled up along the side of the road. And from inside the cemetery, they hear the shot of gunfire followed by a howl of pain. And what the story suggests is that just maybe the resurrectionists return.
I love these stories, Mark. I really,
thank you.
I really, really appreciate your time
with
us today. The Haunted Indiana books, you can find them wherever you get books. Look for them on local interest shelves all around Indiana. And, of course, you can get them online as well. Thank you so much again for writing them. And thanks for your time today, Mark.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm very, very grateful. I appreciate it. And happy Halloween.
Indeed. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow when we'll be talking about Indiana's burgeoning hemp industry. If you have any questions or comments about growing hemp or producing hemp products in Indiana, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.